Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome back to our continuing series on Dharma presented by Professor G. Venkatraman. Professor Venkatraman, sir, is here in our studios. And if you remember, last week we presented Professor's 10th talk in the current series. And today we'll be continuing with a question and answer session based on Professor's earlier talks in this series. And the questions will be posed today only by one member of the panel, and that's Radio Sai's Bishu Prishti. As always, Professor Venkatraman will be answering and clarifying the questions put up by him. So over to Professor for his opening remarks and then taking it further. Over to you, sir.
Over to Bishu. Take it further.
Well, today it is just me. We don't have any other panelists.
Is that a blessing? Or people will begin to think that this is all a rigged session. You and I rigged the questions before.
Anyway,
not really. I can also
This chapter on Arjuna, on which you have your latest musing is based, definitely one of the most important characters of the Mahabharata. And it raises so many questions about war and peace, about means versus ends, understanding the right nature of our duty and so on. And as I was thinking about it, there are two questions that came to me. One is at the physical level and the other at the metaphysical level. At the physical level, when you take the question of war and peace, it is really ironical that Krishna, Lord Krishna, who is the embodiment of Satya, Dharma, Shanti, Prema and Ahimsa, he is fortifying Arjuna to fight. And you have explained how Swami has clarified this, saying that though one must never hurt anyone with a knife, when a surgeon uses the knife to clear cancer, it is termed as a cleansing operation, and it is justified in those circumstances. But what I fail to understand, and perhaps it's very difficult at times to really know how to draw the line between when it is okay to use force and when it is not, because In this example, we say, okay, it was, Swami explained that it was a cleansing operation. But if you see, in today's world, so many wars that have been fought, and you have yourself mentioned how the number of people who have been killed because of wars subsequent to World War II have been almost the same number or more than the number of people who are killed. Now, how do you explain which is just and which is not? How do you draw the line between an operation which was sort of a cleansing operation, so it is fine, and this was an operation which was not supposed to be?
It's a long question, but the very first word you used, or one of the very first words you used, put me off. So I only barely grasped the rest of the question. You said it's ironical. You don't use the word ironical to an avatar. I would say it is ironical that we don't bother to understand the avatar. Anyway,
true.
What you call editorial nitpicking. But the point actually seems
ironic.
No.
Yes.
It seems contrary to intuition.
Yes.
The whole point is, it highlights what may be called how one understands duty. Arjuna had a duty, but that duty looked a little violent. So he says, my duty is not to be violent, especially when the violence I will inflict will be enormous. And likewise, the other party will also inflict enormous violence. So in a sense, he was caught between two duties. The word dharma is often used along with duty. In one discourse, Swami says, what is dharma? One of the associations with the word dharma is duty. It is my dharma to do this, it is my dharma to do that. That refers to duty. I have already pointed out in earlier talks that the Western world has been preoccupied with what should be the nature of action. To put it more explicitly, should it be determined by motivation or should it be determined by consequences?
Yes.
And the vote seemed to be that really it should be based on motivation. If the motivation is all right, the consequences will take care of themselves. On the other hand, there are some people who said, no, you have to be very careful what will happen if you do this. So there are two points of view. That is the essence of Western philosophers. Some were for this side, some were for that side. Basically, it came down to that. There was no way of deciding which is correct and which is wrong in the Western way of doing. In the Gita, Krishna clarifies that point. But unfortunately, he doesn't do it in detail. So definitely, it is not for dummies. And the elaboration for dummies has been done only by Swami, no one else. I challenge you, you go and look anywhere, the kind of very detailed manner in which Swami has explained why motivation is important and how should be the motivation. That Swami alone has explained. So coming back to Arjuna, Krishna, the war, those three issues. There is war. You wanted war. That is, Krishna tells Arjuna. But your motivation was mainly to get your property back. You lost your property. You tried to be nice and tell them, return my property. They would not give you even 5 pinheads of land. So you said, we'll fight. He said, that's up to you. Go ahead and fight. You wanted me, I'm here. But now, having said you want to fight, you come and say, it doesn't look nice from a worldly point of view. So first he gives a pep talk from a worldly point of view. Then he says, you are afraid of killing. Killing is when you are body conscious. So he uses that opening to give him a small lesson on ABC of spirituality. And then at the end he says, what happens in the world is a drama which has been designed by God. If you go with the feeling that you will do God's work, and as far as you are concerned, I am God, then no sin will attach. After all, you are bothered with the sin you will commit by killing. These people are going to die. Destiny has decided they will die. If they don't die in your hands, they will die at someone else's hands. Destiny will make sure those things happen. So, your job is to do what I have already decided. Are you ready to do it? Arjuna says yes, and so on. So really speaking, Gita makes an attempt to link action and duty to motivation. Swami makes it more explicit by saying, the motivation should not be based on any worldly consideration. For example, I am going to beat the hell out of you so that I get my kingdom and also your kingdom. After all, if the Kauravas are defeated, these people can go and occupy. That's after what happened after the World War II. The German Empire, Hitler's Empire, was occupied by the four powers. Russia, Britain, France, and which was the fourth one? America, of course. I forgot America. They occupied the whole of Germany. There were four zones. Even Berlin was divided into four zones. In the east, the Russians entered at the last stage and conquered half of North Korea, which became North Korea. The Americans conquered all the rest, and they said that there was no French, there was no British, there was no...
Interestingly...
So, conquest was the motivation. Defeat and occupy, conquest. Afterwards it was settled with the peace treaty and all that. Whereas here, Swami says, your actions should be motivated by your true nature. Your nature is Atman. That is your natural state. So the dharma you must practice is sahaja dharma or sadharana dharma. These are two words he used. Gurchandra also uses this word. Sadharana dharma. Sadharana means your natural dharma. Natural dharma is not that of your mind, body. Natural dharma is that of the atmic nature in you. And then he goes on to explain what is atmic nature and all that. So this is the new angle that is injected for the first time into the Mahabharata as a part of the Gita Upadesha.
And you...
Is that clear?
Yes, sir.
At least reasonably, I hope.
Yeah. And in your talk, you mentioned this, and you know, you mentioned how the Gita elevates the issue raised by Arjuna to the spiritual plane, as you explained. And
that is by linking action to the nature of the Atma.
Yes.
See, Shakespeare also says, "This above all, to thine own self be true."
Be true. Yes. Yes.
What does that mean? Be true to yourself.
Yes.
That self is not the Dehabhimanam self, but Atma Bhimanam self.
Yes. I mean, in your talk, you end this paragraph saying, in other words, questions about right and wrong, morality, duty, dharma, etc., must all be discussed starting from the spiritual plane. Now, in daily life, sir,
yes,
in our day-to-day routine, roles and responsibilities, how to do everything with our motivation being at the spiritual plane when we are engaged in all the mundane tasks of our life?
See, Swami has answered that beautifully, both in discourses and in conversation at his club. I came here to this studio from the other building. I just normally came here and I sat in this chair and we started talking, and we are now on the air, live, I hope. If I didn't pay any attention to it, it would be mechanical reflex action kind of thing. Since we go through that reflex action all the time, we are not able to think of motivation. So one day Hislop asked Swami, "Swami, I shave every day. How is it spiritual? How do I make it spiritual?" Swami is a master. He has an answer for any damn
yes.
question.
Yes.
That's Hislop, "Why do you shave?" "Swami, I want to look presentable." "So you say, I shave so that when others see me, they smile and I smile. When they smile, I see Swami smiling because Swami is in them. So just to make sure that Swami everywhere sees a nice hislop, I shave." That's the way you should think. Otherwise it is just applying some brush, and, soap, and then drag the razor a few times and that's it, swish, swish, it's over. No, think of it that way. So that time gets credited to your spiritual account. Otherwise it will not. It will go into yes. some, whatever they call, suspense account or whatever it is. So you can convert that. And a lady, she's cutting vegetable. She may think, "This is my husband, this is what I want to do to him." No, don't do that. Say, "This is my ego, this is what I want to do to it." Okay? So, in this way, Swami gave a formula for linking any ordinary thing to spirituality. So I used to try and give a quiz to myself. I want to dry clothes, so I put some rope here and then I tie, clothesline. I put clothes and then put clips. How do I make that into a spiritual activity? I go on a cycle to the shop to buy something. How do I make it spiritual? So these are what you call interesting quizzes. And if you think about it, you can come up with very interesting, amusing, humorous, and also innovative as well as serious answers.
Yes.
We are not used to thinking like that. We rather go, the mind does a random work as I go through. I shave, but I am thinking of what I will do in the office, what letter is going to come, has that fellow replied to my email, all sorts of things will come. And that's why we are careless and we get cut and we shave and all that. But if you change your wavelength to that of living with God, start the day with God, live the day with God, end the day with God, this is the way to God, Swami says, we repeat it. But have you done it? In my view, Saint Tyagaraja did it. If you look through his songs, he wakes up Rama
yes.
and he puts him to sleep and whole day he spends with Rama. It is amazing.
That is what all our rituals in the Indian tradition are meant to spiritualize our life, all rituals as they
say. You must also understand, rituals were part of the Vedic period. In the Vedic period, the enlightenment was much less because they were worshipping the deities, not the Deva, the Supreme One. They were not even aware that there was a Supreme One. That is why Krishna says, go beyond the Vedas. Vedas tie you down, and then you live in the universes of the gunas. Yes, that discipline is needed. You have to go through kindergarten. You can't join PhD class on the first day of school. You go through that. That is all needed. Then you come to a certain stage. You go to a music school, learn, attain some proficiency. Then you look for a vidwan and try to become a shishya of that vidwan. What an eminent person. We have in our hostel some students who have studied with Lal Gudi Jayaraman.
Yes.
I mean, he's a maestro. You can't even think of going 10 feet near him. But these boys attained a level of proficiency and he accepted them as students. So this is the way we go.
Veda, you have to go to Vedanta as Bhagwan.
Vedanta. That is the Bhagavad Gita is the distilled essence of the Vedanta. It goes even beyond Vedanta.
And Bhagwan always emphasized on the Advaitic principle.
Yeah, basically the Advaitic principle he emphasized not because we are going to become Adi Shankaras or anything like that, but for us to realize not to hurt anybody. He said, help ever, hurt never.
Yes.
That was a way of stressing the Advaitic principle. Now you can say, I don't accept that. That fellow hurt me, so I have to hurt him back. That is the motivation for me to hurt another person. You will hurt me, so I am going to hurt you. Now, a Vedantic person will say, you are bound by gunas. It is in your nature to hurt. But I am trying to go above gunas, and I should not try to hurt, even if you do it. That is why you have the Upanishadic story of the rishi who was bathing in a river, who tried to save a scorpion.
Yes.
And which was drowning. And the moment he saved, the scorpion stung him.
Mm.
It keeps on happening. And some villager comes and says, you are an idiot. Let the scorpion die. And instead you are saving it again and again. And the rishi says, it is its nature to sting. It is my nature to save. So we have to learn to switch from one wavelength to another wavelength. From AM to FM, from ordinary phone to smartphone.
Yes.
That's what you have to do.
Yes. And in fact, when you think about it, it all boils down to that aspect of constant integrated awareness.
Absolutely.
You see God in everything, everywhere.
All the time.
And in your talk you refer
to time, space and entity, they are all linked up.
Yes. And in your talk you refer to the Nobel Peace Prize talk of Mr. Barack Obama.
Yes.
And there he very beautifully ends that speech by saying that let us reach for the world that ought to be, that spark of the divine that still stirs within each one of our souls. I think that is very heartening.
No, in fact, that is the message of Swami for the Kali Age. See, you asked the question, there is so much of violence here.
Yeah.
You made a reference to my remark that after World War II, an equal number of people have been killed in the last 60 years.
Yes.
Due to various conflicts, genocides, this, that.
Interestingly, sir, April 2nd, today is April 2nd. April 2nd, 1917, President Woodrow Wilson asked the Congress to send U.S. troops into battle against Germany in World War I. In fact, if you look at the calendar of the world, there will be some news or the other concerning war in every day of the calendar.
Which means war does not get any rest.
No rest. In fact, in that...
No, war should form a union and say, I want holidays.
In this address to the Congress, Woodrow Wilson, he laments. He says that it is a fearful thing to lead this great peaceful nation into war. And 4 days later, Congress obliged and they declared war on Germany and all that. It went on to be the largest war mobilization effort in the country's history and all that.
No, but that was only till Second World War came.
Yeah. But
it's
interesting.
More compelling and tragic is that at the end of the First World War, they planted the seeds for the Second World War.
Yes.
And for all the conflicts that are raging in the Middle East now.
Yes.
Because at the end of the First World War, when the Ottoman Empire crashed, they tried to redraw the map of the Middle East. Middle East didn't have any countries as such. It was all part of an empire ruled by the Turks. And they, like Afghanistan, they allowed the tribes to do what they want. Just say, we are the boss. That was how it was. But then what happened was, they drew borders across tribes. So there is no country. Now they draw a little peninsula border. See, this country, this country, this will be headed by this fellow, that will be headed by this fellow. And there are some tribes here, some tribes here. They did like that. And they created artificial boundaries between families. And the result of that is ethnic conflict right till today. So all this happened started in 1914. They did not see the consequences of what they were doing. Therefore, consequences also are important.
Absolutely.
At some point, the consequences we can't always anticipate. But if your motivation is powerful and very pure, then the consequences are likely to be less harmful. Especially if the motivation is rooted in love. Love has a very antiseptic quality. It kills hate. If applied properly, love is the only medicine that can kill hate. There is no other. More hate cannot be applied to hate.
Yes. But does love all the time work, sir?
Love will work in proportion to your faith and commitment.
Because
that is one factor.
Talk that Obama's peace.
See,
talk.
For example, you want quick returns like a company. I want my last quarter returns. Love won't work. Love is a slow actor. Okay? Now, if the intensity of love is strong, it will multiply. The love of one man cannot conquer anything. The love of Jesus did not conquer the hate of 10 fellows. They came and killed him. The Romans. How many were the Romans? Not like Hitler. They came and killed him. Crucified him. So, the love of Gandhi could not by itself counter Hitler. It is a stupid setup. You don't say Hitler is here, Gandhi is here. You can't play chess where you have only one or two pieces and the other guy has all the pieces. That's not going to work. But if the love of Gandhi had been multiplied, if the power of people had come into the picture, right from the beginning, not at the last day, everything is sinking.
If
then suddenly
people,
say, you call Gandhi, come and let him come and fix the problem, he can't do it.
If more people believed in the potent power of love as much as Gandhiji, sir, then probably things would have been different.
See, that should have started at the time before Hitler came to power. You have to see, Hitler was only the end point of a phenomenon. There were problems in Germany. That is why Hitler came. Those problems came because when the Treaty of Versailles was signed in 1918, the poison weed had been sown. If instead of that there had been what you call love, things could have been different. Now, there is a very good example of this in the Second World War. After the Second World War, Germany had been flattened by ruthless bombing, carpet bombing as they say. And everything was destroyed. The Americans came and occupied it. So did the French and the British. and the Russians. The Russians sort of kept to themselves. And it was a sort of impenetrable curtain, the Iron Curtain, as Churchill referred to it. As far as France and Britain were concerned, they were themselves broke. So George Marshall was the Secretary of State. He was a military man. He proposed, I think Truman was there as president. Eisenhower was yet to come. He gave a speech, I think, in Harvard, where he outlined a plan of assistance to Europe. It later came to be called the Marshall Plan. He said, we'll pump a lot of money. We'll rebuild Germany. We'll help people to build factories. We'll help them to build their roads, bridges, airports, railway stations. A lot of money was pumped in. And people began to get jobs. So all of a sudden they forgot that the Americans were their conquerors. I'm talking of 1947. And then in 1948 in Berlin, this Russians, East Germans created, Russians created a siege. Berlin was divided into four quarters, but it was an island embedded in East Germany. So to go to Berlin, you had to go through East Germany. So they blocked all the roads. Therefore, no supplies of fuel, food, anything could come. Then the Americans mounted what they call Berlin Airlift. You could fly by plane to Berlin. That airport, these fellows could land. Tempelhof Airport, I've been there. So they brought hundreds of bombers and everything came and dropped, brought supplies. And then while going back, the American flyers, they would have kerchiefs. And at the bottom, there is a small bundle of chocolates. They will throw it from the plane, so it will come like a parachute. All the kids will go for chocolate. Instead of saying, Yankee, go home, Yankee, welcome. Thank you.
Oh.
So the Americans did not look as Germans as enemies, former enemies or anything. He said, they are in distress. They need food. They need fuel. They need everything. They brought everything by plane. This went on for more than a year. This is called the famous Berlin blockade. And then the Russians became tired and they stopped it. And that transformed the Germans. So, here was a case where there was a lot of altruism.
Hmm.
There was Swartham, but it was a small percentage. And it made the people, the former enemies, like their conquerors. And that was forgotten. That was forgotten. So, what is the lesson here? I have conquered you. I'm not going to beat you into a pulp. I'm going to give you self-respect back. And Germany bounced back. They became strong in science. They became strong in technology. They became the number one economy in Europe. Number three in the world, next only to Japan. Japan was also built up that way. So the Japanese people forgot their hate. Of course, there are some small points of friction. But if you go to Japan, they, despite the atom bomb, they are dead against the atom bomb. But there is no, you know, hate America campaign.
Yes.
So how you treat the vanquished
is
important.
I mean, there's so much that can be achieved through love.
See what happened after the Bangladesh war in 1971. India at least got close to about 70,000 prisoners were taken in Bangladesh. That country became Bangladesh, East Pakistan. They were all Pakistani soldiers. They were all treated according to Geneva Convention and according to rank. Their head was a lieutenant general. He had a separate bungalow and he had attendants. He had to be treated at the rank of a lieutenant general. And then all of them were sent back. There was a peace treaty signed. They all went back to Pakistan. Nothing. It was done in a civilized manner. And the net result is, except for a minority, most people in Pakistan really don't care to hate India.
Exactly.
In fact, after many years, There was a cricket team that went. That was the first time this Virendra Sehwag went.
Mm-hmm.
And Ganguly was the captain, I think.
Yes.
He said in Pakistan they didn't have to pay for anything. In Lahore,
yes.
If you go to a restaurant, they say, this is on us. Allow us to be your host.
Actually,
they went to shop to buy some salwar.
I was talking to one Sai devotee from Delhi who had recently gone to Pakistan on some assignment of his company. But he said, our perception of Pakistan is very, very different than what it is when you actually go there. Because he said the people there are so homely. He said, you know, they treat you as a guest, like Atithi Devo. They don't treat you as anything different. And they
Not only that, they
have so much of admiration and appreciation of what is India.
See, there is a lot of brainwashing, but beyond that, for example,
he was telling the large majority of Pakistanis love Indians.
Not only that, there is a reciprocity. A lot of Pakistan sportsmen come to Bombay to make commercials for our products.
Yes,
you know. Imran Khan comes regularly. He has his differences, but he comments on the cricket matches, and then he comments in a neutral manner. And at the working level, this is capital has not been utilized properly.
Yes,
there's a lot of goodwill. Chibber told me he has gone so many times on peace missions, and he has met his counterparts with whom he had fought. They'll sit and drink coffee together.
Mm.
Yes, no. It is the real politic people, because Kissinger's real politic. I have commented about it.
Yes.
Who tried to plant suspicion is there for political reasons.
Political reasons.
People are incapable of hating always. You show me a man.
Yes.
Who can hate 24 hours? It is not possible.
Yes. And the large majority of people love to love.
Not only that, you know, it's very practical. People ask me once. Hitler was 100% full of hatred. He said, no, it's not possible. Excuse me. They asked, how do you say it's not possible? I said, it's not possible for a person to be 100% black, or rather evil, because the spark of the divine is in them. You cannot wipe it away. When Hitler was a child, that spark danced, because all children play. And that is a sign of God's play. No matter, I'm sorry, no matter what the difficulty, in refugee camps children play. They don't have food, they don't have anything, they play. It's their nature. So supposing there is a lady sitting in a park with her baby. She's fondling the baby and Hitler goes for a walk. The baby looks at Hitler and smiles. He doesn't know who the guy is.
Yes.
Hitler will smile back.
Absolutely.
That is Atma to Atma resonance. So, nobody is pure evil. It means, at some point of time, even the most evil man responds. I heard our Gangadhar Shastri in our politics department tell me that when Radhakrishnan was the ambassador for India in Moscow, Stalin granted him an interview.
Mm-hmm.
He never granted interviews to anybody, but this was an exception. And then what happened was, just before Radhakrishnan was to return to India, he was to become the vice president.
Yes.
And he was an ambassador when India was a dominion.
Yes.
And the King of England was the notional head of the country. Once he became a republican in 1950, Rajendra Prasad became the president of India, and they wanted Radhakrishnan as vice president, so they called him back from Moscow. So he sent a message to the Kremlin, I want to see Stalin, is it possible? It was just a sort of a trial balloon. Stalin said, okay. So he went there, and Stalin was there, this man was here. They kept talking. Radhakrishnan said, relatively tall man, but Stalin was short man. So he went there to shake hands to say goodbye. Then he sort of put his hand on the shoulder just like this, patted him, and said, don't worry, everything will be all right. I mean, you dare not do such a thing. It's the most powerful man in the Iron Curtain. Stalin was not the president of Russia. He was the general secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, CPSU. Everybody was stunned. What's going to happen? Is Stalin going to fly in a rage or something? It seems Stalin broke down and said, "This is the first time I've been treated like a human being."
Oh my God.
Can you understand that? So, we should never underestimate the divine spark in anybody. Now, do we ever do that? Today's science per se, you are all the time preoccupied with thinking about the transient. You are not even giving not 1% of your time to that which is permanent and the basis of your transient so-called reality. That is very striking.
Yes. In fact, we started that discussion saying the message of the Gita is that everything that we do should have the motivation at the atmic level. And I think that...
Absolutely. Swami says that motivation must be at the atmic level. More explicitly, the motivation must have 5 roots. 1 root in satya, 1 root in dharma, 1 root in shanti, prema, ahimsa. This is putting it figuratively. If you draw those juices and your action is framed, shaped by those juices, it cannot be but divine, in flavor and fragrance.
And when I think about it, when the avatar came down in a human form as Bhagwan, as Satya Sai, we saw that live in action, isn't it, sir? We saw that how everything
I would
that...
I would put it differently. I would say that was there in action. But whether we saw it is a different question.
It was easy because he took a physical form for us to see.
No, physical form, we put it through the filter of our senses. Someone will say, Swami only looked at him, he didn't look at me. How do you know he didn't look at you? He has got only one face, he doesn't have 10 faces to one face looking here, one face looking here. He is looking at one face, but he may be thinking of you. How do you know he didn't think of you?
Yes.
See, we can't evaluate. First thing is to put him in a balance and calibrate him.
Yes.
That is nonsense. But we all did it. Tell me who did not do it. Swami is ignoring me, but he is giving a lot of attention. I am doing so much for Swami. This thought went off in every fellow's head. So, very few people see the subtlety of the avatar. Those who think less of themselves tend to see more of the Swami's subtle nature. It's infinite, we cannot get, but at least you get the fragrance of it. You see how that, though that fellow has made a mistake, Swami is so nice to him and putting him on the race track. What is the lesson for me? There are so many questions like that we can ask. We were always evaluating ourselves against what we got versus what someone else got or did not get.
Yes. In fact, yesterday I was talking to Mrs. Ratanla, who has lived with Swami for more than 4 decades, and she was saying how Swami was never so concerned about so many things that people did, which, for a normal person might get irritated. But Swami just let it go. Swami said, fine, it is their karma. You know, I will love them. I will do whatever. These are the people who would come to him every day and Swami would bless them, help them sort out their problems. And still there would be that narrow-mindedness in them. So there would be certain aspects of their personality which you think perhaps should change now that they have come to Swami, and it doesn't. And Mrs. Ratanlal, she was saying that Swami knew every little detail about their life, but still he would just continue to give and give. It never really bothered him. And when someone pointed it out also, Swami, you are doing this to this person, but this person is like this. Swami would say that it is their karma.
So what does that teach you?
That is what it is. His motivation, as we were discussing, it is only love.
No, you have to put it more precisely. See, he did that because he did not see us. He saw only himself.
Yes.
Because at that plane, there is only he and nothing else. It is an aspect of him wearing the dress of Vishwaprushti. It is like looking at himself in a mirror, which has got some tricks. So he never saw you with your form and your foibles. He saw himself and blessed and smiled and played and resonated. It is a sort of mono act. So Swami says, I am incapable of hatred. To have hatred, there must be two. When there is only, a fellow can't stand there and say, I hate myself. All those fellows who say that, they are doing some mistake. A fellow has done, got out in a very stupid manner in a test match, lost his wicket. So he curses himself. I was a bloody fool. I should not have played that ball. I hate myself. He is hating himself for some silly mistake he committed which cost a match or whatever it is. But Swami doesn't see that person. He only says, that is me playing that role.
Yes.
He has done a good job of acting as a frustrated fellow. So he cannot hate because there is only one. That also Swami has said. So when we try to look at Swami, we must put him in that class and try to understand that how a person at that level will view. We can't do that because we are always interested in division, splitting, pieces, as Swami said.
Wonderful. I think there is so much to... if you look at the Gita, superficially it is something, but when you really deeply analyze, there are such valuable lessons.
Yeah, but then I would suggest, if I may, as a closing statement, that when we look at Gita, we must look at a few things. First is, you must understand, it is a message addressed to different constituencies. So, we must be able to put a filter and say, when Krishna is saying this, he is saying to this kind of people, and Krishna is saying this, he is saying to this kind of people. So, we must formulate a table and put them in different baskets. Now, what is he telling this fellow? What is he telling this fellow? What is he telling this fellow? That's the next thing. Spiritually, this fellow is lower. This fellow is slightly higher. This fellow is slightly higher. So how does the lesson change as the spiritual nature of the person evolves? If you do those things, the rules are similar, but they become more and more general as you go up. What is arithmetic? It is the lowest form of dealing with numbers. Okay? You deal with integers, then you deal with fraction. Algebra. You do arithmetic like operations like multiplication, division, subtraction, addition, except you deal with symbols. It's a bit more abstract. Then there are higher levels of abstraction in mathematics. You can go higher and higher and higher. In Gita, you can see all levels.
Yes.
If you look very carefully. And then you must see what are the lessons. Then you must construct the syllabus. So if I am going on this,
yes,
go on, this is what you do. At some point, Swami will say, look at that form. And then you start looking at yourself, because that form is within you.
Yes.
And so on. So you must construct the syllabus,
yes,
and construct the answers to various questions raised on the basis of the syllabus, in discourses also.
Yes.
And then you will see that suddenly the Gita, which is a small lamp, explodes into something brighter than 1,000 suns.
Fantastic, sir. In fact, that is the reason why probably when you reread the Gita, you constantly keep getting new meaning.
No, you should not reread the Gita. You should reread the Gita and then immediately listen to 5 discourses of Swami.
No,
and then see which part of Gita relates to this.
Yes.
If you do that, then you will say 2 slokas have been amplified by this.
Yes.
In fact, there is one discourse which Swami gave, I think, in 2000, summer of 2000, summer course. It is only on 1 sloka of the 12th chapter.
Yes.
Anapeksha Sudhir Daksha Udasino.
Oh, that was amazing discourse.
Sarvaramba Parityagi Yomat Bhakta Samipriya. I hope I got it right.
Yes.
That one sloka he made into one discourse.
Yes.
And he gave a good deal. He says, don't follow even full sloka. Follow half the sloka. That is more than enough. That is the best sadhana. So you can't get a better deal, better teacher, better anything.
In fact, as I was about to say that the same thing we should do with Bhagwan. Same thing happens with Bhagwan's discourse. When you reread Bhagwan's discourses,
what?
You get new
The other day, I want to end on this. Definitely. In fact, I want to go back to that. I was present there at that discourse. It was a festival day in October 1996. And I remember the first part of that discourse. I have quoted it very often. Suddenly I heard Swami says, so-and-so spoke and he said, who is God? What is God? Where is God? All these questions are meaningless. There is only God, nothing else except God. I remember that discourse. But then when I heard it on the radio just 3 days ago, Swami was talking about the Purushottamas and he gave it an entirely different interpretation. I had never heard this before. Actually, I heard it, but it didn't stick in me. What are Purushottamas? Dharma, Artha, Kama, Moksha. Swami has given one twist. It takes the 4 words and combines Dharma with Artha, Kama with Moksha. So make it spiritualized. This was simply a different ball game altogether.
Absolutely.
It is like converting cricket into baseball. He says, Purushartha, Purusha, who is Purusha? From there, he doesn't talk about earthly things.
Yes.
Dharma, he gives an entirely spiritual meaning. Then Artha, yes. Artha is wealth. He says the only wealth you must acquire is spiritual wealth.
Spiritual wealth.
And then Kama.
Yes.
And Kama normally means lust and other desires. He says the only Kama you must have is hunger for God.
Moksha.
Yes. And Moksha is the road, destination in the road you must take.
Yes.
So he has sort of converted into a recipe for life.
Absolutely.
You have to go back to where he came from. So he takes the same Purushottamas and twists it into something highly spiritual.
Wonderful. I think one exercise that you asked all of us to do, and I think that will be a really very, very ennobling if we really take it up, each devotee can take it up, is to read Bhagavan's discourse and then correlate that to the Bhagavad Gita. Which shloka
Absolutely.
Is Bhagavan
elaborating? See, the teacher in me came out giving homework.
I think that is a very, very useful exercise for all of us. Thank you very much, sir. I think we can go on. But what you have shared today is already so much, is so precious and is enough for us to ruminate on for quite some time, definitely. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Sairam.
Sairam, dear listeners, that brings to an end the 15th question and answer session based on Professor Jivankatraman's earlier talks in this new series based on Dharma. We hope you like this session and we'll be continuing the present series. Please look on our website for and radio announcements about what's coming up next week. So watch out this space. Thank you for listening. And as always, the podcast of this program can be accessed via on our website, www.radiosai.org. And dear listeners, your questions and feedback are valuable to us. You may write to listener@radiosai.org. And coming up next on Thursday Live is the segment Service, Love in Action with Raghu. Please stay tuned. Thank you and Jai Sai Ram.
Spend the day with Sai. From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m.
on Radio Sai's Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
प्रभु रामचंद्र के दूता हनुमंता आंजनेया
रामचंद्र के दूता हनुमंता आंजनेया
प्रभु रामचंद्र के दूता हनुमंता आंजनेया
Hanumanta,
Hanumanta, Hanumanta. चंद्र के दूता हनुमंता आंजनेया।
राम चरण सुखदाई भजो रे, 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 राम नाम के दो अक्षर में, राम नाम के दो अक्षर में, सब सुख शांति समाई रे,
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 साईनाथ के चरणों में आकर, साईनाथ के चरणों में आकर,
साईनाथ के चरणों में आकर,
जीवन सफल बनाओ रे,
जीवन सफल बनाओ रे,
जीवन सफल बनाओ चरण सुखदाई भजो रे, राम चरण सुखदाई भजो रे, राम चरण सुखदाई भजो रे, राम नाम के दो अक्षर में, सब सुख शांति समाई रे,
सब सुख शांति समाई,
साईनाथ के चरणों में आकर, सफल बनाओ रे,
जीवन सफल बनाओ रे,
राम चरण सुखदाई भजो रे।
Tune in to Sight Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m.
on Radio Sai's Thursday Live.
Radio Sai.